Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. It's podcast time. It's daytime.
Yeah, but not like in a super happy way.
Well, I mean, the sun is up, so that's you're not happy the sun is up?
I mean, sort of, if it wasn't through like a veil of smoke, but
A little bit larger than a veil at this point, probably.
yeah. So we are recording this episode, the week that Los Angeles caught on fire in every direction, the whole place is filled with smoke, and the 405 was shut down, which is not something that usually happens a lot. I had an opportunity to not podcast with Dan at night, and we are podcasting during the day. However, during Christmas, if you're wondering why are they talking about the fire so much, and it's because it was recorded in advance.
And I just have nothing better to do, so I'm perpetually available.
Well, you gotta play harder to get. You gotta be like, no, I got something I gotta do, you know? And then it makes you more elusive and harder to get a hold of.
Well, you know what I did before we were getting ready to do this is I ate a pickle, and then I was like, that was a
Oh, a
good
wooden
pickle.
pickle?
It wasn't wooden pickle. It was a good pickle. And then I was like, you know what? I'm still kind of hungry. So I made myself a sandwich that also had pickles on it.
Yeah. What kind of sandwich did you make? Was it a sad bologna and cheese sandwich with some lettuce on it, on white bread? Or was it what did you have going on?
It was turkey and Munster, I think. I already forgot what kind of cheese I put on it. And then, there was some.
Did it
I
have an
got this.
orange edge around it?
No,
Then
so
it's
maybe it
not Munster.
wasn't.
Yeah. Was
What
it
was it?
Havarti?
It was Havarti. That's correct. I
Yeah.
do have Havarti in the fridge there. It was good. And then I had some of this sort of like sweet spicy mustard and a little bit of mayo and some pickles.
Yeah, I had some ham and American cheese because it melts great, not because it's a good cheese. And then you have some mayo and some Dijon with that. Put it on some Dave's Power Seed bread, because you gotta get your Power Seed. And then,
I like to buy all of my bread from some guy named Dave.
yeah, I mean, he there's a weird cartoon of him on the bag. And then you grill that up real quick in your frying pan. And get a nice ham and grilled cheese sandwich thing.
Do
So,
you go cast iron for that, or you got something else?
oh, just a regular pan is fine.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm an expert grilled cheese maker, and there are not many dishes that I would brag about being able to make, but grilled cheese I am flawless at.
You had some thoughts on this on the internet the other day too. I noticed in passing.
Yes, I was talking to former guest Aline Sims. Apparently, she was teaching her husband how to make a grilled cheese sandwich because he had never made one in his life, which I was gobsmacked. But not knowing that ahead of time, I said, "Yeah, there are two kinds of people who can make. There are two kinds of people in this world: those who can make grilled cheese sandwiches and those who can never make them. It's not really like the kind of thing that you can like teach people to do, I find. Like there's like an intuition about like when it's ready to flip and stuff, and like how exactly to heat it through so that you get the meltiness in the inside, but you don't burn the outside, and you also don't like get an overly greasy exterior because it's soaked up grease because the temperature was too low. There's nuance to the
So
process.
you don't want to attempt to tell the audience and me your grilled cheese methodology here.
I would say what you want to do is get your bread, and then you put butter or mayonnaise on it. If you're in a pinch, you can use olive oil, but make sure you spread it out. And you put a little bit of olive oil in the pan or a little bit of butter in the pan, just enough to melt a little bit. And when you see that it's ready to go, either because the oil is shimmering or because the butter has stopped foaming, then you can put your grilled cheese in it. And you can wait until it turns brown. It should be like a minute or two, and you want to have it on like a nice medium heat, and then you flip it over. And if you're going to have a lot of the toppings inside of it, like let's say a deli meat of some kind, like ham, you want to heat that up beforehand before you assemble your sandwich, because if you don't do that, then you're going to wind up with cold deli meat in the middle of your sandwich, or you're going to wind up cooking it until you have hot deli meat, in which case you have destroyed your bread. So that is the top tip. You want to get everything about the same temperature before you go ahead and do that. And if you're using American cheese, it will melt no matter what you do. So you don't really have a problem there. If you're using
otherwise,
something,
you want to bring your cheese to sort of a room temperature before applying it to the pan.
Ideally, because if you don't do that, then you want to turn down the temperature just a little bit more than usual, because you just do want to get that nice low heat in order to warm it up. Because if you go with a hot heat, again, you're gonna scorch the bread, and then you're gonna wind up with cold stuff on the inside of the sandwich. So important facts. And also, don't press the crap out of it when you go to flip it. You just give it a little push just to make sure that the cheese is adhering to everything, but don't like just smash it to smithereens like some people want to do. I see people do that with burgers and stuff too, and it drives me nuts. It's like that's where all this stuff is. Yeah.
Mm. See, mm-hmm. I think when we first got the panini press that somebody bought us for our wedding, I tried to make a grilled cheese in there, and I actually let it close on it, and it squeezed all the cheese out. And then the next time, I used the little hover setting that keeps it just ever so slightly above the top piece of bread, so it just, you know, did its job without squeezing everything out of it.
Yeah, the panini press is a whole different animal. Jason has one of those too. It doesn't seem like it's worth the effort to take out and use.
It's not that bad once you get the hang of it.
Yeah, I guess it also requires a different kind of bread. Like, you don't want to use traditional sandwich bread for that. It's much too thin. You want to use a beefier slice of something, or
right, because they don't typically have temperature controls on them.
No, and so if you use like a little wimpy bread, it's not going to get that sort of light fluffy interior and crust on the outside, because it's been smushed, so there's no fluffiness, and you just sort of wind up with a. Do you ever watch those infomercials where it was like, here's this magic thing that'll go in your microwave and smushes stuff together into little triangles using bread and gets rid of the crust because children hate it or whatever. Remember those infomercials?
I don't think I know exactly what you're talking about in this instance.
Yeah, it was basically like you took two slices of bread and then you put stuff in it, and then it smushed it together, but it only like sort of crimped the edges together, and so you'd wind up with these sort of like triangular pockets of bread that got cooked on the outside a little bit, and then on the inside you had your filling thing. But it was obviously just like white sandwich bread. It was not good.
I also have white sandwich bread. It's I don't know the brand, but it's called Country White.
Oh,
it's good. It works well for my breakfast sandwiches.
Mm. Yeah, I prefer a heartier wheat myself. Or
I don't like wheat bread. Wheat bread's terrible.
Or I also like seeded rye. The bread, not the person. Seeded rye bread is delicious. I like the flavor of it. I remember one time I ordered it at a diner in California, and they looked at me like I was from another planet, and they said, and I asked, well, what kind of bread do you have? And they said, white, wheat, or sourdough. And I said, gross, I'll have the wheat, because sourdough is an abomination of a bread.
No, you take that back. Sourdough is good.
I won't.
What's wrong with sourdough?
Sour.
Yeah,
right,
so?
It's right there in the name.
What's wrong with a little bit of sourdough?
I don't want sour bread. I want nice bread, not sour bread.
Like Wonder Bread, that's nice and sweet.
No, that's Wonder Bread, which is neither. That's a joke that I stole from Craig Kilborn when he did the Daily Show. that's an old joke. That's not my bag. I will avoid. In the order of things, I would go wheat over white and sourdough over white, but wheat over sourdough.
And then rye above all?
Yes. I mean, unless it's like some super gourmet wheat or something that was artisanally made by a local baker, then yeah.
Oh, you're funny with all your bakeries. You know, I was thinking about that listening back to the last episode. You were talking about the local bakeries where you get your croissants, and I don't even know if I know any bakeries at all.
Nothing like bakery in the title, at least.
Like a standalone facility that calls itself a baker. Like, I mean, there's the bagel guy. Like, he makes actual bagels, but he doesn't make anything else. So I don't think he counts as a bakery.
Right. I would agree with that assessment.
Other than that, I mean, I think there's a place downtown that calls itself a bakery, but they sell breakfast burritos.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we...
Speaking of, oh, bringing it back around, I went there with Rye, the person, not the bread this time.
Yeah, well, that's an important distinction. It'd be kind of weird if you're just sitting there.
You took my loaf of rye bread down to the place to get a breakfast burrito.
You get to get a slice out.
And I unwrapped my burrito, and I put the insides in my country white bread, and then I ate it.
You get a slice out, and you draw a little face on it, like Wilson. It's across from you.
I get a slice out, and I draw L.A. Dodgers hat on it and set it across from me.
Oh, they get some really strange looks. I think that concludes our food talk. Mm-hmm. Now we can pivot to a movie that is almost exclusively about beverages, I suppose.
there's also sandwiches and pickles in the movie.
Yeah, there are sandwiches and pickles in the movie. As I was quipping about so hilariously was with the wooden pickle moment from much later in the film, as well as the sandwiches. But my favorite kind of sandwich they make in this movie is the tostada,
which... fried bologna on white bread with salsa on it.
It's like there, a now it's a tostada.
I think that's the most, because this movie purportedly takes place in Arizona for most of it, which it does not. It takes place in California. Mm-hmm. But I like that the only Arizonian thing in this is that the kid goes, that's not a tostada, very quickly, because even as weird and young as he is, he knows from tostada.
Yeah. It's also very obvious that this is not exactly Arizona, but it's the parts of California that most closely resemble it. Now, the part of...
You mean all those rolling hills that have, like, various grasses of sorts on them are not from Arizona?
Yeah, and not just, like, dead brown mounds with saguaro cactuses all over them.
Everything's flat here, except the things that stick up out of the ground, which are brown and covered in rocks.
Yeah, so it's a little different. Also, there's a... Miami does not look anything like Long Beach. I would say that substitution does not exactly hold up either.
Well, there's a bar right there on the sand.
Yeah, I mean, it saves you money on location shooting. I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. You just hop around to a couple places within 50 miles of Hollywood, basically. So this movie starts. And it's the Christmas mall Santa situation. They're getting out of there for the end of the year. Billy Bob is ornery, I will say, and he has his companion with him, Marcus, who is played by Tony Cox, and he is inside of a tiny little suit thing, so he can hide until the guys leave, and then he runs over and disables the thing, and then they all go in and crack a safe and rob the place, and then hop into a van to make it out of there. Mm-hmm. And celebrate their haul.
Marcus has a little list of all the things he wants to steal for his girlfriend or whatever, while Billy Bob is busy cracking the safe, and then they get their $100,000 in cash.
It's technically his wife.
Is it his wife?
Yeah, they also keep flashing the wedding ring that he has on his fingers.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, also Billy Bob Thornton says something disparaging about the wife later at the end of the film when he is narrating his letter.
Well, she's a bad lady.
Yeah, well, not a lot of good people in this movie. So they pulled this off, and Billy Bob's like, nope, I'm all done. I'm out of this. I'm too old for this. Blah, 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 blah. I'm going to, you know, go down to Miami. I'm going to start my own bar on the beach. I'm going to go straight and take care of everything myself, and I'm not going to need you anymore, and blah, 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 blah. And, of course, his buddy Marcus points out, yeah, that's not going to happen. We cut to... Oh, sorry. First, he does a bunch of other stuff, and then he vomits in a trash can when you get the opening title credit, which is it sets up the kind of movie you're going to watch as snow gently falls from the I don't know, whatever is suspending that and barfing snow all over the place. So they cut to Miami some months later, and you get the shoreline. A bar, and Billy Bob Thornton is behind the bar with some sort of aloha shirt on.
Mm, he's smiling, and he's cutting up limes and lemons and looking at people and preparing a drink, and it looks like, hey, maybe he did his plan. He followed through. He went down to Miami, opened a little bar, having a good time. He's gone straight a little bit. And then the bartender shows up and says, get out from behind my bar. How many times have I told you? And he chugs his, vodka tonic as fast as possible before the bartender can get over there and throw him over the bar. And then they start throwing bottles and stuff at each other. And he sprints away because he's apparently just a horrible drunk who is stealing alcohol and causing trouble in Miami.
Yeah, and that really, you know, fits with everything about this movie.
he eats a corn dog and sits on a bench and stares at some women playing volleyball.
Yeah, and but the nice thing about this is usually what happens is you have something where somebody says, I'm not going to do it, and then they cut to them doing the thing. What I like is they cut to him actually following through. Only the following through part is the deception. So that was just a little cleverness, a little twist on the usual thing that you sort of see where it's like, oh, I'm not going to do it, and then, you know, they did it. There you go. And mm-hmm. and the corn dog, the volleyball thing, I don't understand. And he drinks himself into a stupor and passes out in his apartment. And then some Christmas music starts up on the clock radio, and he freaks the F out. Starts listening to his messages, one of which gets cut off prematurely by a beep implying either the message ran out or he pushed the button, but he was nowhere near it to push the button, so I don't understand that editorial choice, but it saved them from having to do a 555 number. He gets the call from Marcus to go back to their crime in Phoenix. He's like, pack your bags, we're going to Phoenix. That seems awfully general and not entirely specific about where you would like go in Phoenix.
It was 2003. We only had four malls, five malls. I don't know.
he showed up to every single mall until he found Marcus. So they meet up, cut to them in Phoenix in a hot parking lot, meandering through, California as Phoenix, mm-hmm. walking through that hot parking lot and going into Chamberlain's, department store. You see a, Santa Claus, mall Santa being dismissed from his job, by John Ritter, who plays a manager of this, department store. And he's very apologetic about it, but he's got a better offer with these great guys this year. They use some inappropriate words in this movie on occasion.
This is an R-rated movie about Christmas, if you're not familiar already.
Yeah, this is not a kids movie.
Has kids in it, but it's not. Kids should not watch this movie.
No, the focus of the target audience is not children. There are some bad words, disparaging words, especially some words that you would not use, and many things that are you could charitably described as old-fashioned or ignorant, but you would not use these words. So he's describing how the Santa Claus that they have hired for this year also has someone with him who is a little person who can portray being an elf, and how that is the thing that they were looking for, apparently, over the previous Santa that they had been using, who is very irate about this whole entire thing.
But apparently he can play guitar, the other Santa.
Yes. I recognize that guy from somewhere, but I don't remember where. He leaves, and then they John Ritter awkwardly addresses the new hires starts to realize there's something suspicious about Billy Bob Thornton and his behavior.
Because he is incredibly drunk and staring at a woman's butt as she walks away.
And not listening to anything that John Ritter is saying until he says, performance. And then he freaks out because it is a challenge about his sexual performance. Is there something wrong with my gear, etc.? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say Marcus shoves him and tells him to go take care of his blood sugar because clearly he's not feeling well is the only reason.
Yeah. He's a little under the weather. It's a chronic condition, that's for sure. So they have their little thing. They go set up and Marcus tries to find Santa. The other elf assistant who is working with him is not a terribly good actress, which is surprising because you're in California, so I think you could swing somebody. But she says that the Santa Claus has passed out drunk behind the thing, and Marcus goes back there, wakes him up, and gets him to go out and sit in the thing. And you get the first kid who comes up after eating some of a chocolate ice cream cone and sneezes that all over his face. And the nice thing is that Billy Bob Thornton takes no guff from these children and dispatches him, then goes to the next kid and so on.
He's a horrible Santa. He's basically cursing and yelling at all of them because he wants nothing to do with it. You couldn't pick a worse person to be around children. He hates children.
Yeah. I mean, would you say he's a bad Santa?
In multiple definitions of the word. Yes. He is bad. He is Santa. He is also a bad Santa.
Yeah. And we are also introduced to the kid who leaves a bus and walks past some bullies who say not very nice things and throw something at him, but he ignores them as he goes inside.
And he has snot all over his face.
And it's a characteristic they like to keep for most of the film. He goes and sits in Santa's lap and doesn't know what to say. And there's a whole process about this. And then he finally says he wants a pink elephant and stuff. He gets out of there. And you get a bunch of other things that happen eventually. The kid winds up protecting him from some weird guy. I don't understand the spat that they got into exactly.
Yeah, so Billy Bob goes to a bar because he hates his life, and he just drinks it away, where he meets Lauren Graham, who is the bartender, and apparently she has a thing for Santa.
As she says, F me, Santa, etc., over and over and over again.
So yeah, they have a few drinks, and then they go have sex in the car, and then afterward, she goes away, and then she... Billy Bob is attacked by Samir from Office Space, who is very angry about something and very troubled and was giving him evil glares in the bar. It seems that perhaps somebody in his life who was dressed as Santa did something bad to him at some point.
Yeah, and you get the first of a few homophobic slurs in the film, but that's nice. The kid takes care of the situation, which endears... him to well not endears that's strong Billy Bob decides to take the kid home in doing so comes to learn that the kid doesn't have anybody looking after him except for his grandmother. His dad is away on some sort of mountain thing.
He's hiking mountains. He'll be gone for a while, years or so.
He's
in prison for embezzlement, which we learn later. He's home alone in his relatively nice house with his grandmother, who is definitely not with it. It's what's her name, right? Cloris Leachman. God,
oh,
why couldn't
I
remember
who it was.
Her name? Yeah, Cloris Leachman is very, I mean, she's, I don't know, I would say underutilized, but she's very talented.
I mean, she basically just sits to have a blank stare and play dead at one point.
She pops up and says, I'll make you guys some sandwiches every now and then runs away.
Yeah, and that's how you know where the kid gets the sandwich thing from, which is nice.
That's the way you be polite in modern society, is you offer somebody a sandwich.
Yeah, and of course you have the situation where you realize that she's not with it because Billy Bob Thornton walks in with a ski mask pulled over his face, with eye holes and a mouth hole cut out, and big heavy flashlight to knock someone out with, or etc.
He's just looking at this kid as a dopey mark for a robbery, which he kind of is. Like, he steals his dad's bundle of money / passport or something and takes his car. But at the same time, he feels a little bad for this dopey kid who's all by himself.
Yeah, well, I mean, initially his plan, obviously, was to violently assault the woman who was there protecting this kid until he realizes that she can't really do anything. And then he decides to only take a couple things, which is different. When you realize that if this had been a spry grandma, as he had been wondering, that he definitely would have actually done something really horrible. So that's unusual in terms of this movie. But it's important for the construction of this that this be the scenario that you have, because otherwise Billy Bob Thornton wouldn't be in a situation to get close to the kid and realize that he's an awful human being and can improve in many ways.
Yeah, you know, he's already kind of got this idea that his life has spiraled out of control and he needs to go straight and stuff, but it's really not until he sees this poor kid who is just like... I don't even know how to describe this kid. He doesn't talk. He's incredibly awkward socially. He just lets everyone pick on him. And even Billy Bob somehow feels bad for him and wants to help him in just sort of like a frustrated way. So he basically berates the kid, telling him all of the things that he should do. But in that way, he sort of becomes a very foul-mouthed, horribly misguided father figure for the
sort
kid.
Sort of. And it becomes obvious in the stories that Billy Bob Thornton recounts that he has some messed up views about fatherhood because his father was not great. But it is important to have the kid there because the kid holds Billy Bob sort of accountable for his behavior, not in an active way.
Yeah, totally accidentally, kind of. Just in the way that he... sort of stumbles, and every time he screws up and lets the kid down in a weird way, he feels worse about himself, which it's weird. You get these two parallel stories where like his work stuff, robbing malls or whatever, is getting worse and worse, and his drinking is getting worse, and he's being more disheveled and ornery at work. And then like, you know, that spills over into the free time after work. And then like, once he sobers up, he feels bad about, you know, being around this kid and being an awful human being, and he tries to do one or two very, very, very small nice things for the kid. Like, I don't know, he gets drunk and tears up his advent calendar and then tapes it back together and puts some candy corn and pretzels and stuff in it. But
my favorite moment in this whole movie is when he opens up that advent calendar and pulls out that piece of candy corn. And Billy Bob Thornton says, "Well, they can't all be winners, can they?"
Exactly. That's a really good line.
Love it. But you know, this is not a movie you could quote large swaths of because most of it is profanity, and also words you should not say. So that's important.
Still, the funniest line is later in the movie when he discovers the kid's real name. It actually made me laugh out loud, as to compared to the rest of the movie, which is just kind of silly.
Yeah, because the kid's name is, of course, Thurman Merman. The father, Roger Merman, apparently thought that was a good name, or presumably the mother who is living with the talking walnut.
Merman Merman.
Do you know who plays the father, Roger Merman?
No. I mean, everyone in this movie is kind of recognizable, but I don't remember him specifically.
Ethan Phillips from Star Trek Voyager. He played Neelix, the most annoying Star Trek character that has ever existed in a main crew cast situation.
Well, okay, yeah, that sounds familiar. I'm pretty sure I've seen an image of that person in a Star Trek uniform.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it took him all of 6 hours to shoot his scene that he's in, but, you know, it's nice to see somebody pop up every now and then. Also, at the beginning of this movie, we have John Ritter in his awkwardness realize that he's made a horrible mistake, but he's not sure how to get out of this horrible mistake that he's made. He very awkwardly tries to confront Billy Bob Thornton about his behavior because apparently he was having... sex in one of the dressing rooms with a lady who worked in a department of the store and shouted something about the ability to go to the bathroom in a weekly calendar cycle.
your effort to sanitize the dialogue is hilarious and just
I'm basically channeling John Ritter's character right now and trying to like not talk about the things that that were actually going on.
The faces he makes when he's talking to Bernie Mac, where he sort of just like scrunches up his mouth and turns his head to the side, is just adorable. John Ritter is the best.
Yeah, yeah, we lost John Ritter too soon. And he does a lot of like tongue mouth things, like with the cringing. And then he just sort of cocks his head to the side and then straightens it back out. And you could tell that he struggles internally with how to do this. He seems to be having a hard time with it. Meanwhile, Bernie Mac, he confronts Marcus and Willie with the information that he had seen them do this thing. And Willie, of course, zones out and then freaks out about the word fornication, which is... and then this is when they come up with the thing about how you can't fire Marcus because that would be awful because of these reasons. And this is when John Ritter very awkwardly puts his foot in his mouth again.
Basically, and, he said they're going to make it into a big old social thing that he was fired for being a little person and discrimination. And you don't want that bad press because you'll lose your job. So you're stuck with us for now. And John Ritter folds, and then Billy Bob basically says he's pathetic for giving in to all this, and then they go back to doing their thing.
Yeah, and they this is when John Ritter goes to Bernie Mac, who is the, I don't know, security detective for the store?
Yeah, he's the chain-smoking head of security, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, he has some interesting affectations in this movie. The oranges.
Western suits, eating mandarin oranges, chain smoking, pedicures with very specific desires for the type of nail polish to be put on his toes.
Yes, the Metamucil-like fiber substance that he consumes.
Right, yes.
Yeah, he's an awfully interesting person. Bernie Mac unfortunately died, I think, like the year after they made this, so he's not in the credits as a in memory of like John Ritter is, but he basically didn't live too much longer afterward. But he delivers a pretty good performance here, and you get the start of his investigation into Billy Bob Thornton, and that's what causes him to go to the hotel where Billy Bob Thornton is staying. And Billy Bob Thornton pulls up and speaks to a lady outside of the motel about the condition of his room, and she sort of awkwardly walks over to the car and says that somebody was asking around for him earlier, and it seemed like it could be a police guy. And so he backs out of there, talks to Marcus, and Marcus says go somewhere else and lay low as long as you don't have anything inside of the motel that you need. So he goes to the only place where he knows that he can probably crash and not have a problem, and that is, of course, the Merman Estate. He just gets the kid to let him in, goes and takes the master bedroom, and lays down on top of the mattress pad, which is gross. Put some sheets on. Come on. And he also grabs a comforter and puts that on top of him. Again, no.
I told
just
the kid
sheets.
That he's got to stay there also because. He got kicked out or at the North Pole because he slept with Mrs. Santa's sister.
Yes, which is funny.
So
because...
It's very helpful for him because, you know, this kid is still keeping up the Santa thing, asking him all kinds of questions about the North Pole and the reindeers and such. And he's just being the worst.
Yeah, Billy Bob Thornton is very good at being the worst. It's particularly nice because he is incredibly impatient, but the kid is incredibly persistent. So you get these two things running up against one another. And
you can't really read Billy Bob's vibes.
No, well, the kid has a hard time reading anybody's vibes. He gets up the next morning. The kid shows him the advent calendar, explains that to him, and how important it is, and reads the story, etc. Billy Bob Thornton goes in for work, and this is the first of many situations where he goes to work, and he's drunk and problems. Ta-da!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for some reason, he seems more sober at the Merman Estate than when he's at his job.
Is this the one where this isn't the one where he comes in and falls over on the donkey, is it?
No, that's the last one. It's the last
straw.
Yeah, that's like, well, of course, donkey's straw. That's pretty normal. The manger. But
it's just, you know, it's the repeating cycle of him sitting there while kids tell him what he wants, and he's losing his patience, and he's increasingly drunk and disheveled and horrible. Because it's just, it's all going to crap.
Yeah, and he has lunch with Marcus, and he's not really eating the salad. It's mostly falling out of his mouth. And I like when the lady brings her daughter up to be like, yeah, so this is Santa. Say hi to Santa. And then he turns around and shouts about how he's on his break and like half of a salad falls out of his mouth.
I distinctly remember that shot being in the trailer, too, because it was quite hilarious.
Yeah. You slowly start to get Bernie Mac piecing together pieces of the puzzle until he figures out the puzzle. But when he talks to... Oh, and there's also a scene here, a character building scene for Bernie Mac, where he busts just some kid who was stealing an Xbox video game.
Yeah, you know who that kid was?
No.
I don't remember his name, but he's the kid who went on to be on Punk'd, the Ashton Kutcher show.
Oh,
when,
yeah,
when
that's
a small child to confuse and confound people.
It's a show that's near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, I know you watched a lot of MTV at this time in your life, didn't you?
No, I think I kind of like tapered off when it was Real World New Orleans. Yeah, I think that was probably the time.
Really get into the Real Worlds and Road Rules after saw half a season. You're like, yeah, I get it now.
Yeah, they're just generally speaking not very good. It's mostly just a bunch of people who get drunk and then shout at each other about everything. That's not too dissimilar from this movie, I suppose. Only Billy Bob's really the only one who gets drunk. Now, Bernie Mac busts this kid, and instead of turning him in or anything else or letting him go, he steals his MP3 player. And tells the kid to leave and pull up his shorts. That sort of gives you some character information about how this detective, this department store detective, actually views justice. It's mainly about punishing things that are against the store, but also still making off with something for himself.
He's strict, but not like because it's the rules. It's because he's in charge, sort of.
Yeah, I guess. When he pieces together everything, he goes and he sits down with John Ritter, and he says, "No, everything's clean, no problems, nothing wrong, nothing unusual, nothing bad is happening.
Can't find anything about him." Yeah, but that's
clean.
A lie because he tracked it down. Although, you know, they do kind of make it seem like he wasn't able to find anything because they, you know, the way he was trying to track him down was by running the license plate on the BMW that he stole from Mr. Merman, which wouldn't come back to him, but he managed to find out that they're thieves and they've been doing this for what he says like 7 years or something now.
Yeah, every year different store, different names, but they always steal everything in the safe and make out with the stuff, which you'd think if they had done this 7 times there would have been like a news story about the common recurrence of these particular sorts of crimes. But
well,
there
must just be so good that they aren't able to tie the crime to the fact that these two were working there.
Yeah, the foul-mouthed, horrible Santa just disappears every year his assistant.
He's not going to come back on Christmas Day because his job is done. They do it on the last day, and then he's not expected to come back.
Yeah, but you get your last paycheck, et cetera. But anyway.
I feel like they are a cash up front business for what they do.
It could be. They have Billy Bob reluctantly talking to people. And this is when the kid gets off the bus again, just like before. Only the kids are taunting him. Cut to inside. The kid walks up and he has some very brown underwear pulled up, very high.
His shoulders, basically.
Yeah, it's sad. Billy Bob Thornton talks to the kid and yells at him for not being more not defending himself. You know, he should get out there and defend himself, and his father would just beat him up if he went home after he got beaten up, and then blah, 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 blah. So the kid leaves.
Yeah, the kid decided he was coming down there to say instead of a pink elephant, he wanted a purple elephant, but then he changed his mind again, and he wanted Santa or something to just beat up all of these kids who are mean to him.
Yeah. A gorilla to beat them up.
Right, yes.
So... He says that to Santa and leaves. Marcus goes to get the next kid, and it's Bernie Mac. Cut to them at a bar discussing the situation where Bernie Mac reveals that he knows everything, and that if they don't cut him in on a taste, as he says, a taste of 50%, then he's going to bust them and report them to the authorities, and they're going to be screwed. So they have no alternative but to go along with this, because they try to negotiate and it doesn't go very well.
Yeah, Marcus doesn't do a very good job of negotiating, and then they argue with each other. And, you know, again, this is the continuing decline of his career as a bandit. And I believe the next time is when he shows up super drunk and falls over on the donkey with a broken whiskey bottle and starts fighting the other stuffed donkey.
Yeah, because this is after they've been allied and committed to working together, because Bernie Mac is then responsible for helping him clean up the situation. And it's quite a situation.
Take him out of the car, get him out of here. Santa's closed for the day or whatever. Yeah. And then he goes home and tries to kill himself in the garage by duct taping the hose of the exhaust pipe from the car into the window. And then kid comes out, basically asks him if he's going to just be hanging out in the car all day today. And he says, yes, kid, leave me alone. Has a brief conversation because the kid is very persistent. Then he notices the kid has a black eye. And he gets so angry that the kid is not standing up for himself that he goes and beats up the kids for him. And just knocks this kid out up against a tree and then throwing skateboards at him. And there's other kids sort of on their bikes on the side. They're just sort of staring at this scene of Santa beating up a bunch of teenagers.
Yeah. And that's another shot I remember from the trailer. But they have him sitting in the locker room after this talking to Marcus. And he reveals to Marcus that he feels really great about what he's done. He's found that he has something that he can do. And that is
some teenagers earlier today. And I feel like, you know, I really did something good with my life. And Marcus understandably has no idea what the hell he's talking about.
Yeah. And also thinks that that he's finally lost everything. He's finally lost his mind. Now an important thing is that, Billy Bob Thornton had handed, the kid a letter, explaining several things about the situation. It was basically his suicide letter that he was handing to the kid, and he says to give it to some cops later on when the paramedics show up.
When they come to take Santa away, there's going to be some cops there.
Yeah, when they put Santa in a body bag. So it was pretty dark, but this is an important turning point for him, because now Billy Bob tries to hold it together best he can for the rest of the film. They're like making popcorn garlands, and his hands are shaking like crazy, and they're. They're hanging up the old lady's stockings on the mantle.
They're having a real good old-fashioned American, really screwed-up family Christmas.
Yeah, they sure are. Until it's finally the night for the thing to happen.
And meanwhile, though, whilst they're having their Christmas, Marcus and his lady pal pretend to have broken down on the side of the road with their van, coincidentally right as Bernie Mac is driving by, and they ask him to give him a jump. In a very sort of suspicious way, and Bernie Mac kind of can tell that something is up, but at the same time, he helps him out, and they squish him in between his car and the van and kill him, so as to get him out of the way, because 50% was just too much, apparently.
Yeah,
plus, and you can't have any loose ends.
This, well, he has lots of loose ends prior to this in Billy Bob Thornton. Billy Bob Thornton was a far bigger loose end than this guy. So they kill Bernie Mac. And this is when the movie takes a definite shift, because up until this point, Marcus was the reasonable one, who, while we weren't necessarily agreeing with his morals in terms of what he chose to do with robbing people and stealing things, he was definitely more put together than Billy Bob's character of Willie.
Yeah, he's the professional, though. Like he knows what needs to be done, and he does it. Like, that's why he holds it together so well at the mall and puts on the show so much, because for him, he knows everything that needs to be done in order for this to be taken seriously and pass. And at this point that they've been found out, he knows that he has to knock off the law guy, because A, he's going to take his money, and B, he'll probably turn him in anyway.
Right. And this is also when he decides he's going to have to murder Billy Bob Thornton for helping him. Because they pack a gun to take with them for this, so they can dispatch him after he opens the safe. And that's important because they go to do the thing, steal the stuff, and they get in there. Billy Bob says that this is a really hard safe that nobody can crack, and then he just does a bunch of stuff to it for a while. And they have a nice thing where they intercut between him hitting it with a hammer and Tony Cox hitting a mannequin with a golf club. They
it was nicely edited.
Yeah, I will say this. While this movie is incredibly crass and lowbrow in a lot of ways, almost always, the editing and the way they chose to stage and shoot stuff is really not that is not bad at all. Especially when you compare it to something like a Seth MacFarlane thing or like a Judd Apatow boring fest. like there's some visual stuff that happens. So they go ahead and they get the stuff out of there, and Tony Cox has his big cart full of junk, Billy Bob realizes that he has to go get the stuffed elephant for the kid. He says, "Got one more thing to go do." He goes up there, he gets the pink one, but he hesitates because he can't remember if it's pink or purple. It was supposed to be purple, but he grabs the pink one, and then he turns around and there's Tony Cox and his wife, and he's at gunpoint being threatened. And this is where Tony Cox is going to murder him in order to get away with everything and not have any loose ends after the detective. And he also explains that the detective had been murdered. Fortunately, a bunch of cops are hiding in the store that nobody noticed up until now.
Not entirely sure where that came from. He said, is that from his letter? Is that what we were supposed to assume?
Yeah, when the cops pop up, Billy Bob Thornton says, "Oh, of course, the kid with the letter," because he had given the kid the letter to give to the cops. But apparently, the kid just gave it to a cop somewhere at some point.
It was hard to tell because, the kid could have just given it to the cops when they showed up at his house in the next scene. But presumably, he took the bus down to the police station and turned it over because that's just what he does.
Yeah, I would guess that is also what happens as well.
He's a very strange kid.
He's a very strange kid. And there's a moment where Billy Bob Thornton shouts at him one last time about everything, and the kid, he says, there is no Santa Claus, etc. Blah 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 blah. And the kid says, "I know there's no Santa Claus. I just thought you'd be my friend." It's sad because you realize that the kid knows that this horrible imposter person isn't really Santa, but he's playing along with it because it's the best chance he has to have anybody hang out with him.
Yeah, he is a little bit dopey, but like as Billy Bob has sort of accused him throughout the movie, like, you know, "Are you messing with me?" The kid is kind of sort of pretending because, yeah, even though Billy Bob is a horrible person who's just sort of wandered into his house and stolen a bunch of his things and kind of just taken advantage of him, it's still better than being left alone without any guidance, apparently.
Well, any guidance or any friends. He has nobody to talk to. And so, like, the highlight of the last few years of his life, basically, is hanging out with Billy Bob Thornton and Lauren Graham, because that's all he's got to go on, really. Like, no, all he has is his grandmother and sandwiches, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's sad.
And he makes a homemade Christmas gift for Billy Bob. He makes him a wooden pickle, which he whittles out of some form of piece of wood and accidentally cuts his hand open with a knife, which there was an odd scene earlier where Billy Bob tries to help by pouring vodka on his hand, which only makes it hurt worse, and then he runs away. Billy Bob is touched by the bloody wooden pickle.
Yeah. So why is it brown? He says, "Oh, it's not brown. I didn't paint it brown. It's my blood." he finds that touching. And that's important because the pink elephant that he's getting now, he runs out of there away from the police as the police are shooting at an unarmed Santa Claus. He gets into a car, pulls out of there, blows one of the car doors off of a police car, goes back to the Merman residence, which seems incredibly dangerous, a bunch of cop cars show up, and as Billy Bob Thornton says, plug Santa 8 times with bullets. So he's riddled with bullets as he's running with a pink stuffed animal to get to the kid.
It's like, you know, he's accepted his fate as being a bad person with these two sides of his life, you know, because when he's talking to Marcus, they're like, "No, I get that you got to kill me or whatever, but like, you know, he's also accusing them of being bad people because they're stealing all this stuff that they don't need, and it's Christmas, and he just wants to give the elephant to the kid. So even in spite of the fact that he's being chased and shot at, he has to get this elephant to the kid before, if it's the last thing he does, and it almost is, except that basically, yeah, he's an unarmed Santa, shot 8 times in the back, and gets the elephant to the front door just about. And then apparently he spent some time in the hospital and he's going to be released because basically the cops shot an unarmed man, and that's a big no-no. And apparently that's a big no-no in 2003.
Yeah, surprise. Surprise. Mm-hmm. And there's an unfortunate line that he says where he said the sheriffs aren't going to press charges because they realized that it was more bleeped up than Rodney King. And it's like, no, that's not a comparison you want to draw right there, necessarily, movie. But yeah,
they have the added bad thing for the cop that there were a bunch of children who heard the commotion because it's Christmas and they popped out their windows and saw Santa being shot in the back by the cops.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some ineffective screaming about that. Those kids are, again, not good actors. I mean, you're in Los Angeles. You can do better. Come on. Come on, guys.
$23 million. They probably spent a lot of that on cars and things that were blown up and smashed.
Yeah, I guess. And the stars of the film, ostensibly. Mm-hmm. This is the end of the film where you get the letter being read by Billy Bob Thornton as we pan across it. And the kid has the elephant with blood on it, and Billy Bob Thornton reasons that that's okay because he got a present with blood on it too. So, ta-da, the circle is complete.
Yeah, apparently the judge is going to let Lauren Graham stay with him for the next year or so because he has no guardian until his dad gets out of prison. And that's okay too, because she likes the house and the jacuzzi, so it's cool.
Yeah, and she likes the kid okay, because she has said a couple times throughout the film how she actually likes kids, she just doesn't have any. And Billy Bob Thornton, of course, does not. That's a nice heartwarming thing, and he says, I'm going to get out of here soon, you know, once I'm all taken care of, and that's it. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Big, dysfunctional, somewhat happy-ish family when that happens.
Yeah, and curiously, he says, like, oh, and I've got money and stuff that I've sent to Mrs. Santa's sister, and I've also got, you know, money to take care of stuff when I get out of here and stuff. And it's like, where did he get all this money from? Because I don't know exactly. Also, even though he got off the hook for this particular crime because of the shooting in the back and stuff, it doesn't mean that he didn't do those other 7 crimes.
Well, apparently the cops didn't figure those ones out. Oh, no, I guess he probably confessed to him in his letter, and that's why they're being lenient on him / arresting Marcus. But yeah, unless he got some sort of settlement for being unsurreptitiously shot in the back by a bunch of police officers, not really sure where he's getting that money.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean,
maybe
it's just
that stack
broke.
He stole from Mr. Merman.
It could be, yeah. It's a weird gift. But yeah, so they did, that's basically where they leave the end of the film. And the kid goes to clean his bike, and the bully shows up with his peroxide hair, and the kid kicks him in the nuts, and then he hops on his bike and he goes off into the sunset with a middle finger over his shoulder.
And he finally stood up for himself.
The end. Merry Christmas.
What a weird movie this is.
This is an incredibly strange movie. I find that there's a very hard shift in tone in the third act from how the rest of the film is just kind of like zany and unfortunate and awkward and sort of relies on challenging good things about things. In Trading Places, when we had discussed that, I had objected to them basically just having something bad happen and then not saying anything about it and keep going. Mm-hmm. And this, they kind of have rebuttals to some of the bad things, but not all of them. So there are a couple times where someone says something disparaging about Tony Cox, and Tony Cox fires right back at them. Marcus fires right back at them. So he's portrayed in a much better light than I think he would have been if this had been a 1980s film. But at the same time, it's not incredibly sophisticated. Surprisingly,
right, they didn't make him the sidekick and or butt of the joke. He's actually the one in charge of sort of this whole robbery crew.
Yeah, he's the brains of the operation. He's the sensible one for the most part. Like they're, you know, it's not making fun of that character. He has basically just as much of a say in things as
he's a bad person, but he's not a weak person.
Yes. He's like you said, he's not the butt of the joke. Even though there are jokes made. And that's an important distinction, I feel like, when you compare it to like Trading Places, where it's like it's still butt of the joke. But this is a very odd movie because it was written by two guys, and then there were rewrites by the Coen brothers for some of the dialogue, but they have it uncredited because of, I don't know, DGA rules or whatever. And then Terry Zwigoff, who directed this, also did some rewriting and rearranging of things and omitting some stuff that he didn't like. And then it was filmed, and then part of this movie was also filmed by a different director because Terry Zwigoff didn't want to shoot some scenes that he didn't think were good, but the Weinsteins wanted to shoot some stuff. And then there was a cut of that they showed to the Coen brothers, and the Coen brothers argued with the Weinsteins, and then the Coen brothers stayed out of it, and then it was just Terry Zwigoff versus the Weinsteins trying to get what he wanted out of them, and there was a negotiation that occurred, apparently, for what wound up being the theatrical cut. Terry Zwigoff has a director's cut that finally went out like 3 years after this movie was released, where he says that it is exactly as he intended it to be. I have never seen that version of it. I've only ever seen the theatrical one. Mm. And I honestly couldn't tell you what was the stuff that he objected to being shot. Also, apparently, Terry Zwigoff had argued with the Coen brothers and had a falling out over the casting of Tony Cox as Marcus. Not for a really good reason, I would say. Apparently, according to Terry Zwigoff, it was because they had envisioned the character as being white, which is... I would have expected better of the Coen brothers than that, but that was apparently something that they were really hung up on.
The Coens wanted that?
Yeah. Mm. According to the Terry Zwigoff interview that I had read, of course that's, you know, him saying that about them. I don't know if that's actually true, but apparently that was part of the reason why he hasn't collaborated with the Coen brothers since then. It was the process of making this film and the arguments that he had with them. But he said some nice complimentary things about their dialogue punch-ups, because apparently, I can't even say the thing that they punched up, because it was, he says, Jesus the blank Christ or whatever. And it's, of course, the F word. They just rearranged some dialogue into some better curse words, I guess. It's just really strange. Also, the Weinsteins being involved is also weird, because, news about them these days. Apparently nothing untoward had occurred in relation to this movie that I am aware of, but you never know, because they're just charming in every way, mm-hmm. Shape and form.
Yeah. Without getting too much into that, I'm not certain either, but... Mm.
Yeah, I this is all stuff that I read afterwards. And I forgot that the Weinsteins even produced it until I was watching the movie and the opening credits came up. And then I saw Miramax and I was like, uh-oh. And then I saw the title cards come up and then I saw, uh-oh, there's one Weinstein. Oh, there's the other one. There we go. They were producers on it. But yeah, that's how the cookie crumbles. And apparently, Terry Zwigoff does not think very highly of them either. So that's good.
Go figure. Apparently, he has the most... standards or dignity of all of the people who worked on this.
I don't know.
Yeah, I did. I probably just God, what's? Never mind.
Yeah, so that's awkward. But I thought it was important to bring that up, because someone might notice that when they were reviewing things about this film. But overall, Dan,
mm-hmm.
you were saying this is an incredibly weird movie.
It is a weird movie, yeah.
And did you hate it? Is it okay?
I mean, it's hard to really like quantify it or compare it to other things. No, I didn't hate it. As a Christmas movie, which, you know, it does sort of, the third act does sort of come around to like spirit of Christmas and what it means to be a good person and family and that sort of stuff in a very strange, strange way. It's not a Christmas movie to me, but like, I don't know when else you would watch this. Like, this is the kind of thing you're going to fire up just any old time of the year and enjoy yourself some bad Santa. It's fine. It's not bad.
I mean, I think it is a Christmas movie. In the first two acts, there's still some of that Christmassiness because he's awful. He's an awful person. You see that challenged by the expectations of everyone else who expect him to be a good and decent human being. He isn't. Mm. So you have that tension at play there, and you have people trying to do the right thing and people who believe in the holidays, notably the kid, how that all plays out. So I like that. I don't think it's as Christmassy as many other Christmas films are,
right, no,
certainly.
I mean, it's Christmassy, and I guess they sort of throw a wrench into the expectations too by staging it in Phoenix, where it is never Christmassy in general. Because it's always sunny and there's never any snow on the ground. But yeah, I guess I just mean that this is not a movie that I would personally like choose to revisit around Christmas time unless we were doing something like this.
That's fair.
That doesn't mean it's a bad movie. Like, it's, you know, yeah. Still a fine movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give this movie any awards. Apparently it was nominated for a lot of awards, but...
is it really?
Yeah, well, Billy Bob Thornton was nominated, I think, for Best Actor or something, for either Golden Globes or Oscars or both.
I mean, he puts on a pretty solid performance as this horrible character.
But he lost to Bill Murray in Lost in Translation. Mm. And Bill Murray was one of the people who was interested in being the Willy character in this film, but... couldn't do it because he had that would have interfered with his filming of Lost in Translation. So it's kind of a good thing he did Lost in Translation, but wouldn't that have been weird if you were watching this movie with Bill Murray in that role?
He could do this. He could do a version of this movie. It would not be as profane or sexual as it is. I don't see Bill Murray doing that.
Well, That's just you putting Bill Murray in a box.
that's me assessing what I think Bill Murray is able to do as an actor.
Uh-huh.
Or what he is good at doing, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily would have liked that. I think this might be the only time I've ever liked Billy Bob Thornton in a role that I've seen, because he plays such a horrible human being, and he does it with such... accuracy, I guess.
he's gross and dirty and weird, and he fits perfectly with this character. He's also quite good in the first season of Fargo, which is another role that he fits quite well. But yeah, this one, it fits him well.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think Bill Murray would have been a great bad Santa.
They have to change the title. Mediocre Santa.
Like, yeah, less than ideal Santa.
I mean, Bill Murray also has his own holiday movie that we discussed last year, Scrooged. So go watch that one.
Yeah, no, he's good in Scrooged.
Mm-hmm. But that concludes everything I got to say about this one, I think.
Mm-hmm. It's not Phoenix in this movie.
No, it's not. Thank you, Dan.
It's not what it's like here.
Here, I put some salsa on it. Now it's Phoenix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was like it was really like. Bad salsa too. It's just like watery big chunks of tomato. Like that was like some paste picante or something.
Yeah, that's what it looked like for sure.
It's not, I mean, we have better salsas than that here, even at our Safeways.
Well, I mean, you have to look at the other ingredients he's using. I don't think he was all about the best of the best. Exactly.
Do you think he actually acquired those things to make that meal, or was it just he was just cooking up what was in the fridge or whatever?
I am not sure how this house works, to be perfectly honest, because presumably the grandmother is supposed to be taking care of the kid, and she does that the rest of the time, although she seems completely out of it. But maybe she is just affected in such a way that she can still do things that she considers to be regular tasks, like go to the grocery store and make sandwiches.
She would write up a list, or they would just have a list of things to buy at the grocery store, and the kid would take the bus to go get them.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is like he might just be in a rut of knowing only what he knew to get from before his dad went away, and so he just does that, and then the grandmother makes sandwiches out of the stuff that he gets from the store.
He knows how to take the bus down to the mall, but that's about it.
Yeah. But for some reason, they're always fully stocked with stuff to make sandwiches at that house.
Sandwiches are a staple for most folks.
Yeah, it's really a very important food because it has a lot of elements of other food groups represented inside of it in a compact vessel that you can transport to many places and enjoy.
Yeah, did I tell you about my sandwich earlier?
Yes, you did tell me about your sandwich earlier. That was literally the first thing we talked about.
It was a pretty good sandwich.
did I tell you about my grilled cheese earlier? Yeah.
yeah. So yeah. When you said butter and or mayo, are you using mayo as the lubricant for the pan grilling kind of thing?
No, you never use mayo for the lubricant for the pan. But the mayo, because it's basically just an emulsion of fat, it can turn into a brown crispy coating that's perfect on the outside of the bread.
Yeah, you're talking about mayo on the outside of the bread that touches the pan.
Yes, but you're not lubricating the pan with it. You don't put a spoonful of mayo in it.
Right, but in a sense, you're lubricating it just on the bread side.
But it doesn't lubricate. It just crisps. It basically fries because it's just fat.
That frightens and disturbs me a little bit, I guess would be the way to describe it.
Yeah, it's a trick I learned, I think, from Kenji Lopez, who does the Serious Eats blog stuff every now and then. He has a cookbook. The other thing that most people do is they put butter on the outside. Same principle, it's fat, and then it crisps the bread. It's not lubricating the pan, it's basically frying the bread.
Mm-hmm.
You basically can do the same thing with a little bit of mayo. Now, you still should put butter or oil in the pan in order to actually have that there, because otherwise you get a mess. So do that part.
So, but does hot crisped mayo taste good?
It has no taste. Like you wouldn't be able to discern that it was mayonnaise at all.
Pretty skeptical about all this.
Okay, well, don't put like gobs of mayonnaise on it. That's not what I'm talking about.
You
just put
a very. Does that apply?
Oh my God, Miracle Whip that's a whole nother different thing.
I don't know what kind of mayo we have in the fridge right now, but I think it's in a squeeze bottle, so it's probably not real mayo.
It depends. Some of them, they've perfected the art of putting real mayo into a squeeze bottle, but
says mayo on the bottle, but I don't know. It's probably no fancy LA brand.
I'm not using a fancy brand either. I'm using Best Foods because you can't get Hellman's, which is real mayonnaise out here. Stupid Rocky Mountain division.
Isn't it exactly the same?
It's supposedly exactly the same, but I just like Hellman's, and Best Foods just sounds ridiculous. So there you go.
Mm. Yeah, be wary of things that have best in the name.
Yeah. But supposedly, I think the best mayonnaise you can, according to like taste tests and blah, 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 et cetera, is like the Duke's one from the South, et cetera, in like Texas area, in Louisiana and stuff.
If it's one thing the South knows, it's mayonnaise.
I guess. I'm not like a mayonnaise connoisseur, and I certainly would never put enough on it in order to taste distinct qualities of the mayonnaise. It basically just exists as a helpful spread in order to make things happen. But yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not gobs of mayonnaise on anything for me.
Mm.
As long as it's not as long as it's not like light mayonnaise cut with canola oil, that stuff. You know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't think I do.
There are all the like super duper low-cal things, and then they're just full of all kinds of crap. And then it winds up having very strange properties to it in comparison with regular mayo. So just use regular mayo, and just don't use that much because you don't need to. Very little goes a long way.
I still don't think I'm going to ever try this.
Okay, well, I'm not. It was not. At no point did I advocate this for you for as a lifestyle. But stick to butter. Butter's fine. Butter works well.
Mm-hmm. I feel
the important thing is that you put something on the bread, because a lot of people just don't do that, or they only put something on the bread and they don't put anything in the pan.
You're talking about
which is also
on the outside of the bread.
Yeah. Some people put spread butter, but like because they don't have like spreadable butter because it's been in the fridge, they just tear up the bread, and then they also have chunks of butter disproportionately spaced out over the bread surface, and then they just drop that into a dry pan, and then they cook that, and that makes an inferior grilled cheese. You do not want to eat that. At the very least, make sure your butter is warm enough that you can spread it without just tearing up the entire surface of the bread, and then you also want to put butter or oil in the pan in order for it to coat the pan enough for you to actually cook the thing evenly, because no matter how well you spread it on the bread, you're never going to hit every single point on the surface with what you have spread, and it will not melt in such a way that it will coat everything evenly, because that's not how it's going to work, because you spread it on the thing.
I feel like the first time I ever made a grilled cheese sandwich, it was at a friend's house, like over summer vacation or whatever. And he just, you know, loaded up one side of it with whatever country crock spreadable butter or something he had, and then threw that in the pan. But the trick that I use these days when you don't have the time, or the you messed up and didn't warm up your butter, is when we're using the panini press, I take the stick of butter and just like rub it all over the panini press to sort of lube it up, and then the end of the stick is now moistened, and I just rub the stick on the bread right after that.
Yes, the end of the stick is now moistened. Mm-hmm. That's basically how when you're having a Cuban sandwich and you get it heated and pressed, which is the only way to order it, what they do is they take the press, which is basically like a panini press, but just no ridges, just flat.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes it'll have foil or whatever on it because they can clean it easier. And then it has butter over the whole surface. And then you put the sandwich on and you push the thing between those two because you've just put a little bit of butter on either side. And then that crisps the bread, but doesn't give it that fried texture of like a grilled cheese.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some of the sandwiches that I've put in the panini press with this methodology have been homemade Cubans.
Mm.
No, not with Cuban bread, because we don't have Cuban bread. Sorry.
I know. It was one of the nice things when I was in Tampa last time, and I went to a place called Bodega, which is in St. Pete.
Is that internet startup that's going to replace
corner stores? Different one. No. This was technically, I think, a corner store. Although right now it's just a restaurant, basically. There's no interior. You sit on the sidewalk, or there's some bar height stools and stuff around the sides of the building. And they have a very limited menu of things that they do, but it's all good. You got your Cuban sandwich. You got your pan con lechon, which is your roast pork only sandwich with some onions on it. And lots of garlic, and that one is also delicious. If you happen to just like the roast pork by itself, because sometimes people have a Cuban sandwich and they're just like, you know, it's just like ham and Swiss and whatever, and like there's only a little bit of that roast pork stuff. I'd have a whole sandwich of that, and it's like, well, guess what? You can. It's just called something different, and you can order that at most places. You can get a Cuban sandwich, and the good thing is it had Cuban bread, delicious Cuban bread. And it's mostly just made at the same commercial factory that makes all of the Cuban bread. And it has a wonderful consistency anywhere you go in the Tampa or Miami area. Mm-hmm.
That sounds tasty.
Yes, very tasty. I'm going to make you go to Tampa sometime. I will come up with some convoluted method to make you go there.
Unless it's some sort of like podcasting convention meetup that somebody's actually paying for. Which is not going to happen because we don't have nearly enough listeners for that sort of thing. I don't see you getting me to go to Tampa.
It'll happen someday. Someday I'll force you to go there and have a Cuban sandwich. Although, knowing you, you'd probably go there and then you wouldn't have a Cuban sandwich, or you'd have like one that was available only at the airport or at some Starbucks or something.
I go far out of my way to try the local fare of a certain place.
Well, that's true. Maybe you would go all the way to Tampa and then you'd drive to Miami and have a Cuban there and then drive back.
Probably.
Give up halfway through because you didn't realize it'd be so far away.
I would fly to one of them and then drive to the one that does the salami because I like that version better.
That's the Tampa one.
Yeah, I like the Tampa one then.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed, because why not have salami? It's one of the weird things about the Miami version. And there's no like good reason not to have the salami other than it just evolved differently. And so now it's just tradition that you either do it one way or the other way. But yeah, the Tampa way is superior. Salami.
Salami. Mm-hmm. Are we still doing this? Is this still the show?
I think we kind of talked about sandwiches for a while, but
you gotta bookend this podcast with sandwiches, much like two slices of bread bookend a sandwich.
Precisely my thinking. And so we have griddled this thing. It has been heated and pressed.
Slather this podcast in butter and heat it up.
Yep. May all your acquaintance be forgotten.
Oh my God. How did you just make a Christmas/mayo/sandwich reference all in one sentence?
Well, technically, that's New Year's.
But, God.